I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The four remaining Republican presidential candidates held their 12th debate last night on CNN. And unlike their previous ones, there was no talk about body parts, no shouting matches, no interrupting, no name calling. Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and John Kasich were civil and debated each other on the issues: trade, immigration, Common Core, terrorism. Trump was asked by moderator Jake Tapper if he stood by his comment earlier this week when he told Anderson Cooper, "Islam hates us." Here's a clip courtesy of CNN.
There is tremendous hatred. The question was asked, "What do you think?" I said, "There is hatred." Now, it'd be very easy for me to say something differently, and everybody would say, "Oh, isn't that wonderful?"
Mr. Trump,
we better solve the problem before it's too late.
Senator Rubio.
Here we go. See, I'm not interested in being politically correct. I'm interested in being correct. And in order to be correct on this issue, here's the bottom line. We do work. There is Islam. Islam has a major problem on its hands. It has a significant percentage of its adherents, particularly in the Sunni faith, but also in the Shia, who have been radicalized and are willing to fly planes into a building and kill innocent people. There is no doubt about that. It is also true that if you look around the world at the challenges we face, we are going to have to work together with Muslims who are not radicals. We're going to have to work with the Jordanian kingdom. We're going to have to work with the Saudis. We're going to have to work with the Gulf kingdoms. We're going to have to work with the Egyptians to defeat, for example, ISIS.
Well, we asked Ryan Grimm to join us. He's Washington Bureau Chief for Huffington Post, also a contributor to MSNBC. And Ryan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
That's good to be here.
Was that a good debate last night?
It depends on what you're looking for. I mean, certainly the previous slugfests were much more entertaining in the carnival fashion. This one was a bit more civil, and you could actually have watched it with your children and not necessarily be embarrassed for the state of the country. On the other hand, the positions that were being outlined remained extreme, and in fact got even more extreme. You had people on stage saying that all Muslims, we're talking nearly 2 billion people across the globe, hate the United States. And even after the debate, Donald Trump was asked, "Yeah, but you have friends that who are Muslims, and you've said nice things about them. What about them?" And he wouldn't even acknowledge that his own friends that he has said nice things about don't hate the United States. So, that's a level of extremism that we haven't quite seen yet, but it was said politely.
Which is sort of how people say things versus what they are actually saying, because it can get very distracting when people use a different kind of tone, and oftentimes what they say gets lost in the tone.
I think the most extreme candidate who's no longer in the race was probably Ben Carson, if you just simply went by the scale of their positions. But he would speak so softly and so calmly and almost mumble that you would say, "Well, he seems like an awfully nice guy. He can't be. He can't really mean what I think I'm hearing him say." He's one end of the spectrum, and last night's debate was towards that end of it.
Well, interestingly, Donald Trump was also asked to defend comments that he has made about torture, about killing families of terrorists, which are illegal. But he didn't back down on that as well. And he talked about fighting ISIS or our enemies, whoever they are, on equal footing. Now, the other candidates distance themselves from that, but he's holding true to that.
Yeah, and the only sense in which he did somewhat back down or offer a concession to the American people is that he is not saying that he won't do those things, which are illegal by international law and U.S. law, but he is saying that he will work to have U.S. laws changed. He will try to legalize waterboarding and other forms of torture. While promising to engage in them. So his concession is that he will change the law. Now, I suppose he could also say that he's going to renegotiate the Geneva Conventions and call that a lousy deal for the United States. But you're right. He has decided that not backing down is the smartest political move for him, even when he takes, even when it came to criminal violence at his Fayetteville rally against against a man who people call a protester, but there's actually no evidence he was protesting. It appears rather that the man who was sucker punched was only being escorted out of the rally because they thought he was a protester because he was black.
And John McGraw, the man who's been charged with assault, battery, disorderly conduct, apparently told Inside Edition that he liked, and I'm quoting here, knocking the hell out of that big mouth. Yes, he deserved it. The next time we see him, we might have to kill him. And I think some of the questions have been raised, and it's not the first time that someone at a Trump rally has either gone after a protester or someone that doesn't look like they fit at a rally. This obviously was an assault here. Whether there are things that Trump has said that have gotten people to that point. What do you think, Ryan?
Well, he said, I mean, we have the virtue of having it all on camera. He has said, get them. He has said, I will pay the legal fees for anybody who does so. He said last night, these people are doing a lot of damage and they need to be dealt with. He's not very veiled in the way that he's encouraging the violence, which frankly may itself be illegal, inciting other people to violence. This is a pivotal and a critical moment in our history, because the way that these things have evolved in other countries is that you have these kind of random individual acts of violence among people who believe a certain thing. And if they don't get punished, other people see that. And the next phase in the evolution is they start organizing the violence. And if that doesn't get punished, they start forming little groups and they start wearing the same types of clothes and going out and carrying out violence against people that they see as opposing their vision of making America great. And that's where you get the phrase brown shirts. You have these kind of, these kind of JV groups that go around committing acts of political violence. And this is how it starts. And it has to be stopped by punishing the people who are doing it now, so people don't understand that this is okay.
Well, it's interesting because a number of really high-profile Republicans have called out Trump for some of his incendiary language. And you wrote about a secret meeting that was held over last weekend, essentially what to do about Trump. These are Republicans talking about that. Do you think the Republican Party itself has done enough to address some of the violence that has taken place at these Trump rallies?
Well, I mean, no. I mean, and they've kind of, they've fueled a lot of the anger over the last, 7-8 years that has led us to this point. And, last night, Donald Trump, in being asked about the violence at his event, finished his answer by praising the police. And many police officers do tremendous work, and that needs to be said.
Sure.
In that particular incident, the person who was sucker punched was surrounded by police officers. And the man felt like he could punch him with impunity. And police, in fact, then took down the victim. And the man spent the rest of the evening in the Trump rally and was only arrested the next day when the video went viral and it became an embarrassment for the county sheriff's office. So by praising the police for not taking action against a person who was acting violently in his rally, Trump was sending a signal to other police officers that that's kind of how he wants them to behave. And one interesting Trump phenomenon is that he very much has strong support among police officers, which is, could go in a number of directions.
Do you think he can be the nominee, or we have to wait perhaps till next week and perhaps a couple of weeks after that to see how he does in places like Florida and Ohio?
Well, I mean, the math so far is undeniable. It's awfully difficult for Ted Cruz, or and certainly impossible for the others to get to 50% by the time of the convention. And the way that the rest of the primaries and caucuses are set up is to Trump's advantage. There are a lot of winner-take-all states. Florida and Ohio, Illinois, these are winner-take-all places, which means that even if he only gets 35-40% going forward, he gets all of the delegates, and it becomes very difficult to see how he is stopped by any conventional means. Now, the establishment has made it very clear that they're thinking of any unconventional means that they can come up with too, but they've been rather feckless so far, so that would be some misplaced confidence if that's where you were putting your money.
And what do you mean about unconventional?
Well, unconventional means at the convention. We haven't had a contested convention until kind of the first half of the last century, in which, you know, on the first ballot, nobody has 50% plus one of the delegates. And then all of a sudden it becomes a melee because none of the delegates at that point are bound to the candidate. And Donald Trump, we know this from a staffer of his who has said so publicly, doesn't understand the delegate process, and therefore his campaign has not invested any time or resources into the delegate process, which means a number of Trump delegates, while legally required to vote for him on the first ballot, might not be actual Trump supporters. And so, you know, might be up for some types of negotiations. So that, you know, that's where the kind of unconventional melee on the convention floor could come around. And much of that, I think, though, depends on what his approval rating is and what his head-to-head is against the Democrat at the time. You know, if he's far down against the Democrat, then Republicans are going to be, and even his supporters will be more willing to dump him.
Some Democrats are wishing for Trump to be the GOP nominee. Do you think they should be careful what they wish for?
You know, you always should be. You know, history is stacked with people who thought that they, you know, that certain events were, you know, just a prelude to their own success, and they found out that that was the complete opposite. To me, Ted Cruz is just objectively a much more beatable and predictable candidate for somebody like Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders than Donald Trump is, who you know, you can't really go on you know, past experience to try to predict how it's going to go. Now, he's so unpopular among so many people that it does make it difficult for him, but you know, you can't be sure. He's a wild card.
Well, Ted Cruz is doing better against Donald Trump than the other candidates. Do you see a path for him to win the nomination? About a minute before I have to say goodbye to you.
Sure, his path is for him a difficult one, which is to consolidate establishment support. If Donald Trump is at, you know, let's say 40 to, you know, between 35 and 45%, Cruz needs everything else. He needs the other 55%, and if he can do that, he can win. But he has spent his entire time in Washington and much of his life alienating people, alienating the people that he very much now needs. And so the question for the establishment is which poison pill do they want to swallow, and they don't want to take either of them.
Ryan, Ben Carson endorsed Donald Trump this morning. Do you think that will help him?
Every little bit that he can pick up helps. And Ben Carson had just a hilarious line when he was endorsing him. He said, quote, "He's a much more reasonable person than comes across," which is just such a ringing endorsement from one person to another, which is actually kind of appropriate since I guess Carson is much less reasonable than he appears.
Well, we have to end on that note. Ryan Grimm, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It was a pleasure.
Washington bureau chief for the Huffington Post, also a contributor to MSNBC, talking about last night's Republican debate. After this very short break, shifting gears, talking about Maria Sharapova, tennis, and doping. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. Maria Sharapova is a five-time Grand Slam winner who defeated Serena Williams at Wimbledon in 2004 when she was a teenager. She's the highest-paid female athlete in the world who has made millions in endorsements and products. She surprised a lot of people on Monday at the Australian Open when she announced that she tested positive for the drug meldonium that had just been banned by the World Anti-Doping Agency.
I wanted to let you know that a few days ago I received a letter from the ITF that I had failed a drug test at the Australian Open. I did fail the test, and I take full responsibility for it.
This announcement rocked the tennis world because of her status. Porsche, Nike, and Tag Heuer have withdrawn their endorsements, and she will be suspended tomorrow by the International Tennis Federation as she waits for a tribunal date. Well, joining us to talk about Maria Sharapova's failed drug test, what it says about tennis, the media, sports, and the state of doping, is Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine. has served for as a sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Howard Bryant, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us is John Wertheim, and he's a Sports Illustrated's executive editor, a senior writer, co-author of a book that just came out called Your Brain on Sports. And John Wertheim, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Pleasure to be here, especially with Howard.
Nice to have the
two. Hey, John. No Indian Wells for me this year. I apologize.
And you
were in hotels scattered around the country. Howard, let me start with you, but John, I'd love to have you jump in on this as well. What is meldonium? Where did this drug come from? And apparently Maria Sharapova had been taking it for about 10 years.
Well, it's a heart drug that is not approved by the FDA, not for use or not for sale in the United States. However, is very popular. I believe the origins were in Latvia. But it's very popular with the Russian Federation, and that's one of the reasons why this story is so interesting in a lot of ways, because as we found over the years, there are many, many different countries that have suffered doping scandals, and one of the common threads throughout those scandals is common use of certain drugs. And with the Russian Federation, this is one of the drugs that has been sort of flagged in one of the in across several sports for them. And I think one of the other interesting things about this story so far has been it reminds me very much of baseball, where we have use of a drug, but we don't have a lot of evidence that people have heart problems. It's like once baseball banned amphetamine, suddenly we saw a spike in Adderall therapeutic use exemptions in baseball. So once again, players are going to find the things that they need to replace or provide some of the effects that certain drugs can give them, even if they don't have symptoms for what the drug is used for.
Well, Dick Pound, former chief of WADA, said her behavior was reckless beyond description. And John, I know that you talked with her lawyer to try to understand why she took this drug. Apparently, she and other tennis players were told, or other athletes, I guess, told that this drug would be on the banned list a couple of months ago. She did come clean. I mean, she admitted that she took it. So you have to, it seems to me, you have to give her that much.
Well, she came clean after she had been alerted to a positive test and sort of beat the, she won the press conference. We can debate the virtue of having a slick press conference after you know you've been caught already. I think what Dick Pound was referring to, and I think your broader point is right. I mean, this is interesting about Maria Sharapova, but really this gives rise to an interesting discussion about ethics and doping and competitive advantages. What Dick Pound was referring to was the fact that Maria Sharapova says that for years and years and years, 10 years, she'd been regularly taking this drug. As Howard notes, this meldonium is not licensed in the United States. It's not FDA approved. And it moved on to this banned list on January 1st, and athletes had been warned about this. We're now learning repeatedly throughout the fall, hey, listen, the list is changing. This meldonium is one of the drugs that's now going to be on the banned list. And for her to continue taking it and ignoring these warnings is either recklessness, carelessness in the extreme, arrogance. I mean, I think what Dick Pound was referring to was, look, even if this was for therapeutic use and not performance enhancement, the fact that she didn't have the time to open an email pertaining to a substance she'd been taking for 10 years, you would think that if you know, an athlete had been taking a drug for 10 years that wasn't licensed in the U.S. and they had this empire founded on sort of probity and grace and doing the right thing, they wouldn't eat a potato chip without first checking to see if it was on the list. The fact that she continued her use was really mystifying to a lot of people, and I think that's what Dick Pound was referring to.
Well, and also one other thing, John makes a great point, and the other thing that underneath what John just said is that Maria Sharapova lives here. She's been
in the
here
US.
Entire time. She is Russian, but she's lived in the United States since she was, what, 14?
Something like that.
And I mean, I also, as soon as she made that announcement, my email box started flooding in with sports scientists, a doctor at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, saying her reasons were that there was a family history of diabetes, which had a certain irony, too, as she is a sugar purveyor and has this candy company, but also that she had low magnesium and an irregular EKG. And what I was hearing again and again and again from doctors and sports scientists was it just doesn't add up.
you would not be taking this drug for, you know, you can get a magnesium supplement at CVS. And if you are really a teenager with an irregular EKG, that's potentially serious business. You're not going to take a Latvian drug when you live in the United States that's unlicensed, unregulated by the FDA. It just, her reasons for taking this sort of triggered a fair amount of suspicion.
And being a world-class athlete at the same time with an irregular heartbeat as a teenager after winning a major, I mean, I think that would be, that qualifies as news.
Well, if she were a college athlete and had an irregular heartbeat, she would be sitting out the season. The fact that she would take a Latvian over-the-counter drug unlicensed in the U.S. and then resume playing with an irregular EKG triggers a lot of questions.
Well, I have a lot of questions here, and let me toss this to you, Howard. Could she have gotten a health exemption, for instance, to be, say, I need this drug for my health conditions?
Well, and that's one of the questions. I think that's also what Dick Pound meant when he was talking about recklessness, and that's also one of the issues when you're trying to follow this story. I think that when we talk about this, there are so many different areas to go at, so many different angles. One, of course, you're looking at the actual story itself. Two, you're looking at the reaction from the public, from media. Then you're also looking at the truth from when the doctors start popping up, as John knows from his emails, when they start saying, by the way, this doesn't wash because we're not doctors. Yes, obviously, if there was some sort of medical history in her family, that would have been preferred. You could have made the argument that since it wasn't on the ban list, there was no reason for a TUE, for a therapeutic use exemption. On the other hand, the question for me that has remained throughout all of this is, if no one is saying you would use this drug this way, then why would you have a therapeutic use exemption anyway when the drug is not supposed to be used for 10 consecutive years? From what I had been reading on it, it said that you would use it for 4 to 6 weeks at a time. And so it really does not make sense. But what's interesting to me is when we've heard about this, at no point have I seen anybody really discuss whether or not this is cheating, which is the entire story. No one has yet really discussed the five majors that Maria won and all the championships and everything that she's done. Is that to be deconstructed? Right now, the stories that I just finished reading, you know, Chris Clary and one of his pieces, and you know, Ben Rothenberg in the Times, talking about, well, you know, she's not the only one. Well, somewhere along the line, we have to have some sort of common conversation about what all of this means. Do we just accept that doping is that people are going to use whatever they can use until they're told not to use anymore? Or and has the ethical conversation of, well, we all play with what our gifts give us, and that's it. Is that simply a naivete, and that's gone? That's out the window. That's yesterday.
Well, let me toss this to you, John. It's something that Howard just mentioned. I'm holding in my hand here a story from the New York Times. More than 60 athletes have tested positive for meldonium. This is according to the World Anti-Doping Agency, saying that 60-plus people have tested positive. They have not gone public while their cases are still being adjudicated. So what does that tell us?
Well, I think the context is important too. That these are 60 athletes that are all concentrated from a cluster. This is a lot of Russian and Eastern European athletes. There's obviously been a recent Russian doping scandal that completely laid bare the sort of systematic cheat. I mean, Russia's whole sports science infrastructure has been completely sort of splintered by this recent scandal, and I think that figures into this as well. I do think Howard's point is worth dwelling on a bit more, which is, if something is not on the banned list, is it sort of, can you still cheat? And I think the notion that, I mean, look, this is a drug that was not devised for performance enhancing. It was given this initially to elderly patients recovering from heart attacks. It seems, and I think there's some debate about this, it seems to have some performance-enhancing qualities, so it's always going to happen. People are always going to play around with dosages and compounds, and a drug that was approved for use X will be found to have athletically-enhancing qualities if taken in context Y. And it does seem as though the testers found that there was a high incidence of this drug, and so they moved it to the ban list. That's what always happens, too. I mean, the testers are always playing catch-up. That's just the nature of this. And again, I think it does bear, I think Howard's question is a good one, which is, can you still cheat even if the substance you're taking is not per
exactly,
se illegal.
Even if it's legal.
Well, what's the answer to that, Howard?
Well, to me, when I was reading this, when it all first happened, I was thinking, okay, so what we have is an issue of legal versus illegal doping. That's what it seemed like to me. It's like, okay, well, you don't need this drug. However, it's not banned, so therefore take it. Is that cheating?
Right.
To me, the answer is yes, of course it is, because you don't need this, and it's giving you something obviously, some sort of benefit. I remember one day speaking with Jason Giambi, who was with the Oakland A's and New York Yankees, when he had finally admitted to using steroids, and although he'd never failed a test. And I remember him saying, the stuff never even really helped. And I'm like, well, then why did you take it? And I remember him saying, because players feel like if they think it helps, whether it really, really helps or not. And one of the points that he, you know, I remember asking him, Jason, you were tested for using Clomid, which is a fertility drug. What are you doing? And so once again, you start asking yourself, okay, if a male baseball player is using Clomid that is not necessarily, it's on the banned list now, but that is not banned, is that cheating? Of course it's cheating, because why are you using something that you don't need?
Well, Howard,
also for a different purpose, too. I mean,
and also for a different purpose, exactly.
Well, and Howard, I saw you being interviewed, and you talked about performance enhancing versus performance enabling. Now we're really getting into the weeds here. But, I mean, athletes do things all the time to obviously be in the best tip-top shape that they possibly can.
Yes, well, Marty, but that's also one of the things when we talk about misdirection and we talk about saving the narrative. And I know we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but I was amazed at the speed in which Porsche and Nike and Tag Heuer dropped Sharapova or suspended Sharapova, because one of the things that athletes do to win the public over, it's the cheating shield, is to say, look, I was not trying to get an advantage. I was trying to help my team, or I was trying to get back on the field. So there's the performance enabling conversation.
Right.
These drugs were, like Andy Pettit, for example, who used HGH. These drugs I used so I could make my team better. And then the public says, well, yeah, that makes sense. He was just trying to be a good teammate. So
there's a baseline argument too, right, Howard, where what we always hear is, listen, what about Lasix? And what about corrective eye surgery?
Exactly.
And then it redounds to, are you getting it to be 2020 or are you trying to get 2010 vision?
Well, in fact, I saw some players saying, look, there, I'm afraid to take a pill. I'm afraid to take a cough drop or a nasal spray for fear that I will be accused of doping or cheating. John, is that an extreme response or does that seem legitimate?
I think that's an extreme response. And I think that, you know, you look at this list, and this banned list is not some cloak and dagger list. I mean, anyone, you can, three keystrokes and the three of us could all go through it. I also think, I mean, at some level, athletes can't have it both ways. And you complain about the competition, and everybody wants a clean sport. Part of a clean sport is a lot of drug testing, and part of a clean sport are tough restrictions on what you can and can't put in your body if you – But again, I mean, athletes say that, and then you look at the list and you say, look, if I needed vitamin supplements or I wanted extra vitamin C, it's very easy for me to see what is banned and what isn't. I don't think it's quite as dire as that. But again, you can't have it. If you want a clean sport, you need rigorous testing.
Howard, let me read a couple of tweets from Jennifer Capriati. I mean, a lot of Serena Williams and others seem to give Maria Sharapova some credit for in a sense, coming out and accepting what she did. Not so Jennifer Capriati. I'm extremely angry and disappointed. I had to lose my career and never opted to cheat no matter what. I had to throw in the towel and suffer. I didn't have the high-priced team of doctors that found a way for me to cheat and get around the system and wait for science to catch up. I don't know if that's Jennifer Capriati, how she feels about a lot of things, but I thought her criticism was pretty direct.
Well, exactly. As somebody who had to play against Maria Sharapova, and also who's someone who's had her own share of public incidences, I'm sure that there's always, when things like this happen, there's always going to be the equivalent versus the false equivalent versus the next equivalent, and the social media equivalent. Well, what about this? And what about that? And what about this person? And so I think that seeing the other athletes come forward was a natural response, and I was waiting to see how many other players would actually take on Sharapova, considering she's a giant in the sport. And it was actually interesting that not too many. I think that Capriati so far has really been the only person out there. And I think that, and she's not even active. So this goes back to several other elements of the story. And one is the fact, and John knows this far better than I do, that the attitude around tennis or the attitude about tennis is they're not trying to catch people anyway. This was sort of a shot in the dark because people have been talking about the physicality of the sport increasing over the years, and the Nadal Djokovic 2012 Australian Open that was 5 hours and 53 minutes when Djokovic played a 4 hour and 50 minute against Andy Murray the day before, and people have been asking how do they do this, and yet no one in tennis has been of any real prominence until now had been busted for any sort of PEDs.
Well, about a minute before our break here, John, you said in some of your writing that the system worked. Sharapova, the top female tennis player, the highest paid female athlete in the world, admitted that she took this drug.
There had been a conspiracy theory that sort of tennis was happy picking off the smaller players, but no stars were being caught, and now we have an enormous star. And I think one reason this has been followed so closely is this sets a huge precedent, and this really impacts tennis. I mean, Maria Sharapova is the highest grossing earning female athlete, never mind tennis player. She makes more money than any other female athlete. This is as big a star as you can get, and I think that the way in which this is handled, the way in which her defense and appeal will be adjudicated, I think that sets a huge precedent one way or the other.
And that's John Wertheim, Sports Illustrated's executive editor, also senior writer. He's got a new book that he co-authored called Your Brain on Sports, also with us Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, and we are talking about Maria Sharapova's failed doping test, what it says about her, what it says about tennis, the media, sponsors, the state of doping. 1-888-477-9499. We want to know where you stand on this piece of news this week. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Howard Bryant and John Wertheim about the news earlier this week when Maria Sharapova announced that she tested positive for a banned drug, a recently banned drug by the World Anti-Doping Association. It's called Meldonium. And talking about what that says about the state of her sport and also her career in this sport and also doping itself. 1-888-477-9499. Howard, there one of the articles that I was reading raised some questions about some other players. Rafael Nadal, he was out for a period of time in 2012, and one wondered whether he was using an excuse of injuries to cover up for the fact that he might have been using some kind of banned substance, raising questions about whether athletes are using injuries so they don't have to get tested. Do you think there's some truth to that?
Well, that was one of the issues that John had brought up earlier about tennis not really trying to catch people, and that tennis would actually allow some sort of mask of an injury to hide a drug suspension when drug suspensions are supposed to be announced. I actually think the Nadal comparison is interesting in another way, and that is there's this phenomenon that I always refer to as selective justice, in that there are some players that are always suspected of using drugs and some players that aren't, that you'll see a guy test positive for HGH or whatever, and someone will say, nah, he doesn't look like a steroid user or something like that, as if we can actually tell what the sophisticated nature of these drugs can do to a person. We have no idea. And if you look at players, if this had been Serena Williams, and we could obviously go in there on many different levels.
Sure.
If this had been David Ferrer or Sara Errani or some of these other players who had been linked to either previous drug use or some of the doctors who had been caught, if this had been Rafael Nadal or Novak Djokovic, the public reaction would have been very, very, very different. The public reaction would have been, see, I knew it. And because it's been Sharapova, the reaction has been very different. Once again, no one has actually talked at all about, well, gee, does this make her two French Opens illegitimate? Mm. It's really interesting to me how the player creates the reaction and not and not the actual failed drug test.
Howard, is that because she's beautiful and blonde and 6'2"?
I think that would have something to do with it when you're comparing her 6'2", 125-pound body to Serena Williams' 5'9", African-American, 160-pound body, absolutely. But it really is, it depends on the athlete. And even if you took Novak Djokovic's 6'2", Serbian, 176-pound body, I think people would look at him very, very differently, and he would not be receiving the benefit of the doubt.
You agree with that, John?
I don't, actually. And I mean, first, I think we should veer away from speculating. I mean, there's, you know, Nadal and Djokovic and Serena. I mean, these are not players who have been, other than sort of eyeballed, have been implicated in any way. And I also think that the reaction here was very swift. I mean, I don't think Maria Sharapova has gotten a pass. I agree with Howard that she's not one of these players who people watch on TV and say, oh, she must be dirty. However, there have always been some sort of inconsistencies with her, some gamesmanship. Her grunting was seen as flouting of rules.
Absolutely.
And the reaction in tennis has been very swift. I mean, this is not, you know, Blondie getting a pass here. I mean, Nike did not wait until dinner before distancing themselves. This is
less than 24 hours. I was actually amazed by that.
I mean, less than 2 hours. And this is a company that stuck with Tiger Woods and with Lance Armstrong. I mean, Nike really backed up quickly. And I think, in part perhaps triggered by that, that really sort of set the narrative in a much different course. And I think a lot of people were not buying this press conference. Sharapova has actually a Philadelphia-based lawyer who spoke at the press conference that he's been trotted out several times since, which says to me that this damage control has not necessarily been working. I've heard Ari Fleischer is going to get involved. No one's turning a blind eye here. I mean, I think this – and I think it's appropriate. I mean, I think, again, there are a lot of unanswered questions here. But I do not think this is a case of Maria Sharapova – you know, conventionally beautiful, ergo she's getting a free pass. I mean, she's...
No, and actually, John, neither do I. And the reason why I don't think so is, one, we haven't heard from the Federation. She might get socked for 2 years. So it's not this story is finished. It's actually just beginning. She might get 4 years. She might get 3 months. We have no idea what's really going to happen, although you might have some inside information. I don't really know what's going to happen with this next. But the reason I brought it up was simply I was actually more talking about the public. Because you've had the swirling rumors about the Spanish Federation, that people have been talking about Spanish tennis players for years about that, and that they would not be getting sort of the this is a surprise type of thing. I actually think that this is actually very good in terms of people who want a clean sport, because instead of looking at that sort of selective justice thing, people are the Federation seems to be simply just following the rules. Here's what you tested positive for. Here's the penalty. And that is actually as good an outcome as anybody could ask for. I was thinking more about the public, because the public has dogged certain players for no reason other than looking at a player's body or looking at how a player performs and saying, oh, well, clearly that person is using some sort of PED. And you never heard that.
I think this will sound trite. I think a lot of good will come of this. First of all, that tennis has shown that big stars are not invulnerable. I mean, again, this is all being outsourced, so it's not really tennis who's going to even maybe making this.
Which is why it should be, which is another reason why you need it outsourced.
Exactly. But the other thing, I mean, just on a much more baseline level, what it does is says, look, I can't look at someone on TV and say, oh, she's too skinny, she can't be using performance-enhancing drugs. And I think we've all kind of recalibrated. But I think in the court of public opinion, she's getting hit pretty hard. And I think that, you know, the tennis is a small sport. Their agents represent multiple players, and multiple players have different contracts. So Maria Sharapova's racket sponsor, actually at odds with Nike and Tag Heuer and some of the others, had a very strong statement yesterday saying they're sticking with her, and it went into how many milligrams she was taking. And within half an hour, that Andy Murray, who's represented by Head,
as is Sharapova,
came out and said, I disagree with that, and I can't understand that, and was very outspoken in his opposition. So I think that, again, she won the initial press conference, and there was this sort of trope of she owned it and good for her for coming clean. And since then, that was Monday, and since then the narrative's really changed. And I think we need
more information on it. But here's one other thing too, John, that I was interested in what you thought on this, because it hit me pretty hard. And Marty, we talked about this a little bit earlier.
Sure.
And it was the speed in which some of these corporations just dropped her. And I was thinking, immediately I went to Tiger Woods when it came to Nike, and immediately I went to Lance Armstrong, just as John did. And I was thinking, what have you put in the bank? Do you have a reserve in the bank? And it seems like post-Tiger and post-Lance Armstrong, especially Lance Armstrong, that these corporations, there is no reserve in the bank anymore. And maybe it's because we've reached a level of cynicism that, okay, when this happens, we know that the denial is coming. We've seen the denials in very rare cases. Has the denial ever been vindicated by the truth? Usually what happens is...
No one knows this better than you. I think that's a great point. I mean, no one knows this better than you, but at some level, context and history is really important here. And we are, as fans and as consumers, we are jaded to alibis. We've seen too many Lance Armstrongs and Marion Joneses. And
that's right.
I do think that when Nike spent so little time backing out and then other sponsors predictably followed,
I thought Nike was going to stick with her.
That's an emphatic message.
Well, you know, let me jump in here.
We're going to stick with her.
I'm enjoying this back and forth because it's really interesting. But let me get some callers into the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking with Howard Bryant and John Wertheim about Maria Sharapova's failed doping test. She had a press conference earlier this week. And what it says about the state of tennis, what it says about the sponsors, several of whom dropped her pretty quickly, and, of course, the state of doping itself. And I should add, according to what I read today, the International Tennis Federation will decide tomorrow about her suspension. Let me see what Vinny from New Jersey has to say. Vinny, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I've been listening, and I don't really understand. What does the drug do? I take heart medication my whole life. Or AFib and stuff, I can't see it helping me play better. When I played sports, I even took it, and it didn't enhance anything. So I'm kind of confused. What does this heart medication do?
Well, Howard or John, let me toss that first to you, Howard. My understanding is it gets more oxygen, into the,
yes.
Into
well,
the
every,
muscles?
Every sport. Every sport has the drugs that help it. And in tennis, the one thing that you need is endurance and recovery. Those are the two things. You don't need muscle mass in tennis. You don't need anabolic steroids to play tennis. But you do need more endurance, and you do need more recovery. And supposedly, those are the two benefits of this drug.
Is that true from your perspective, Howard?
You mean John?
This is John. No, I mean, I think this all is about sort of circulatory conditions and enhancing physical capacity. I mean, this is a Latvian drug unlicensed in the U.S. So talk to player after player from outside that area, and they'd never heard of this thing. So this is not a common. But I do think the idea is enhancing physical capacity, which is true with a lot of drugs. The other thing, too, is that, and Maria Sharapova has already this came out in the head racket statement, that she was taking a much lesser dosage than some of the other athletes who have been caught. I mean, that's her assertion. So, you know, if you take four times the recommended dose, that might have a different impact. But it's all about sort of physical capacity.
In fact, a tweet from Renee, the level of intensity of the drug should be considered before ruining the career of a naturally above average athlete. Also, an email from Richard said, isn't it likely that the ITF told Sharapova if she gets out in front of the issue and doesn't drag it out, she will likely receive a light suspension, i.e. the biggest tennis star so far, she would receive the ITF as an example of their efficient enforcement. A more cynical view, I guess, that ITF was doing this, Howard, for their own reputation.
Well, the one thing that did surprise me, and I don't think I've seen this really anywhere. I mean, there might be precedent, but I don't quite remember it with a player of Sharapova's magnitude, is announcing the failed drug test before the Federation announces the failed drug test, that I'm going to have a press conference that here, this is coming down the pipe, that you don't see that very often. And so
I looked into that, and it turns out that she failed the initial test. She was warned, and then she had a period in which she could ask for a beta test, basically take another sample, have a retest.
B sample, yes. Mm-hmm.
And so the ITF was prohibited from saying anything until they had that beta test, that B sample. And in the interim, Sharapova took it upon herself. So there was
And she declined to have the B sample tested.
Right. But that's why she also beat them to the message. So there was no sort of complicity. There was no, hey, get out in front of this. She basically said, I'm going to waive my appeal and instead make this announcement. So it actually seems as though the process was pretty fair in that case.
Yeah.
And she waived the right to an appeal to basically beat the announcement.
And of course, the benefit of getting out in front is to ask for a little, is to go to sort of suggest a little lenience, don't you think?
Mm. I wonder, too. Absolutely. I mean, she's 28. She's had some injuries, as a lot of, I guess, quote-unquote, older tennis players have. Hadn't done so well against Serena Williams more recently. Do you think, Howard, that, you know, this she sort of hit the top of her career and now faces that long slide down?
Well, no, because I still think that, for me, when I look at the WTA, there's only one player Sharapova can't beat routinely or at all, and that's Serena. She hasn't beaten Serena since 2004.
Right.
However, there's not another player out there that can say, yeah, I've got Maria's number. It doesn't really work that way. She's still the second-best tennis player when she's healthy. The only reason that her rankings has slipped down to six, or I think she's at six right now, is because she's not playing, is because she's hurt. Very few players out there can go out, you know, even have a winning record against Sharapova. So I didn't see that. However, whatever happens on Saturday or in the coming days, if she gets socked with 2 years, her career very well may be over. I mean, she said that she doesn't want to play, but I also believe that she would change her mind because she doesn't want this to be the last memory of her tennis career. But the timing of this couldn't be worse for her because she's trying to come back from injury, and in coming back from injury to also maybe get hit with a year-plus ban would be very, very difficult for her to come back as a top player. I mean, the world keeps changing if you're not on the court.
Yeah, and I wonder, too, about her particular brand, John. You mentioned the fact that she's got a line of candy. I believe she has a line of sunscreen or sunscreen products. Does this hurt the Sharapova brand?
Unquestionably. And I think that's really underlying a lot of this. I mean, we talk about her career. Well, her career is part of it as a competitive athlete. Part of it is someone who makes eight figures a year being Maria Sharapova. I mean, I think that's one reason she's probably not in a great rush to retire. But no question, this does huge damage to the brand. And, you know, I she has her own line of candy. Again, there's a certain irony to that, given that diabetes figures prominently in her in her story about why she was taking this drug. But her real money comes from these blue chip sponsors, from Evian, Cole Haan, Tag Heuer, Land Rover. I mean, we could have a whole segment on her endorsement list, which is needs to be serialized. And there's no question. I mean, one of the reasons that she was such an attractive endorser is because she had a certain level of sort of grace and business-like savvy, and not unlike Tiger Woods, that's been completely ruined in the last 4 days.
Howard, I'm giving you the last 30 seconds. Final thoughts.
No, I'll take 15 seconds.
Okay.
I'm going to be interested in seeing how this plays out. And I really think that the game is the ban. What that does, that will tell you what the sponsors do. That will tell you what she's going to do. That will tell you how the other players are going to react. And once that happens, I mean, if she gets 3 months and she's out and she's back for the Olympics, if healthy, then I think this story will begin to dissipate very quickly.
On that note, my thanks to both of you. Howard Bryant, thanks so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, John Wertheim, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks as always, Marty.
And he's a Sports Illustrated's executive editor, senior writer, and again, co-author of a book that just came out called Your Brain on Sports. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. Download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Sign up for the newsletter. And you can also listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you.